You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. Today I want to give an update, but I've been thinking about what should we do about both our military personnel that have been sent to West Africa, ostensibly to train people there in how to handle patients with Ebola, but also primarily, to my understanding, is to build facilities that can accommodate Ebola patients. Some of these personnel will come in contact with Ebola patients, but the general understanding is few, if any, will. That this is strictly training and construction to assist the West African nations that currently have experienced over 10,000 cases of Ebola, over 5,000 deaths, that will easily increased over 10,000 deaths in the coming months. What do we do with our own military personnel? Now, yesterday, the Secretary of Defense approved, at the recommendation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that all our troops that are on missions in West Africa, in other words, Ebola responsive missions, be quarantined for a period of 21 days. That makes a lot of sense to me. First of all, if you're in the military, no matter what service, you're under orders. So you will do what the government or your commander orders you to do. That's the way it works. And when you sign up, you understand that. So our military has no choice in the matter. If they're ordered to be in quarantine for 21 days, they will be in quarantine for 21 days. It's not like the nurse in Maine who went biking yesterday. Now remember, she's in rural Maine and she went on a bike ride, and that technically would violate a voluntary quarantine, because she's out in the public. Now it's up to the governor of Maine, LePage, to go to court and get a court order to quarantine her, and apparently he's going to do that. We're waiting to see, but that's the next step. You can either do this voluntarily and stay in your home, or if you're going to insist on taking bike rides or meet the public outside of your house, then it's up to the public health officials in Maine to take what they think the appropriate action is, and that is really a state-by-state decision. Because public health is very much the responsibility of the states. Not President Obama, not the Center for Disease Control, the states. And the states are taking action. Many states now are, some very quietly, such as California, but many states are now insisting that any healthcare worker that has been treating Ebola patient in patients in West Africa, when they come back to the United States, they're obviously going to be screened, their temperature's going to be taken, and they're going to be asked some questions. One of the first two questions, were you in West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea? And if the answer is yes, were you treating Ebola patients? And if the answer is yes, then what's going to happen is those people, depending on which state you're in, are going to be put in mandatory quarantine. Now, that means staying at home. And the reason the public health officials do that is to minimize your contact with the public. And remember, you don't have to have the disease. A lot of people are really confused about this. You don't have to have any symptoms of the disease to be put in quarantine. The key criteria is that you were in this country treating Ebola patients. And because the incubation period for the Ebola virus is highly variable from typically 2 to 3 days minimum to 21 days, with the more typical being 8 to 10 days before you show any symptoms, that's how they come up with the 21 days. That's what the World Health Organization is saying, the Center for Disease Control is saying. However, as I said on yesterday's show, the World Health Organization, when they determine a country has been Ebola-free, they use a 42-day period because they understand why about 95% of the cases occur in that 21-day period. You still have another 5% that take longer. At the 42-day period, approximately 98% of all the cases manifest themselves in symptoms. So you need to understand that point. What sort of amazes me is why this nurse is making a big deal about staying home for 21 days, saying it's unconstitutional. Lady, you're endangering your own neighbors. I understand you're healthy and don't have the symptoms. That is true of the doctor that's now fighting for his life in Bellevue Hospital in New York City. He was symptom-free. He was a doctor treating Ebola patients, I believe it was in Guinea, and now he's fighting for his life. He didn't have any symptoms for the first 7 days he was back. And he made the mistake that I think you're making. He went out in the public, in this case, New York City, riding the subways, riding in taxis, going to a bowling alley, eating at a restaurant. And now he has come down and been confirmed to have the Ebola virus. And that is in the window, that 10-day, the average, 8 to 10 days before you show symptoms is the more typical situation, and that's the situation here. That's why all these states, the governors of these states, are taking the precautions and insisting on a mandatory, not a voluntary, a mandatory quarantine of 21 days. Is it inconvenient? Yes, it is. But I don't see the big deal here. What if you're wrong? And I say this to all the health care workers that come back. What if you happen to be the unfortunate individual that after a period of time, whether it's 7 or 8 days, 21 days, or for that matter, 42 days, break out in the symptoms of Ebola and it's confirmed you have it, and let's take the worst case, and you die. Because of your actions, in other words, not volunteering to be in quarantine for 20 days, you have the distinct possibility of infecting your neighbors, your friends, your family, and your neighbors. As much as I salute and applaud their efforts going over there, I don't think this is unreasonable at all. And I think the people that have the medical education understand this. And it escapes me why they would risk, even if it's a low risk, of infecting people in their own community. As someone said, think of the difference between 21 days and 21 deaths and running the risk of a possible epidemic, if not a pandemic. And they keep saying, well, that's the science. That's the medical science around it. Well, the medical science around it knows it is a variable incubation period. Just because you don't have the symptoms on day 7 or day 14 doesn't mean on day 20 or 21 you start the symptoms and it gets worse. What might very well happen is if either this nurse or someone else comes back and takes the same attitude, and I think it's a rather arrogant, selfish attitude of endangering their own neighbors, and then comes down with the Ebola virus, they'll be the first to want to go to the hospital and get treated for it. But they're going to have a guilty conscience. They're going to be forever sorry that they put their freedom of movement for a limited amount of time ahead of their own community and really the people of the United States. I hope she's thinking about that. And I hope all of you are thinking about it. No one wants to stay locked up or confined in their apartment or in a home for 21 days. You do get cabin fever. But you live in the United States, you'll have access to television, you'll have access to books, you'll have access to music, radio, while you're at home. And you're not going to be alone. It's all right if your family sees you or your loved ones, but you want to limit the number of contacts for the simple reason, if you go out like this doctor did, there are potentially hundreds of people now that could be infected with the Ebola virus and don't even know it. And what you need to understand, and this is what drives me nuts about the federal government on this, yes, you need to be in direct contact, physically contact the patient, specifically his body fluids, his perspiration, his sneeze or a cough, blood, vomit, feces, urine. And the people that treat these patients are trained and know they have to wear what they call PPE, personal protective equipment. And I've included, and I really recommend, for those that, let me first say this, for those that are new to the show, first go to my companion blog for this show is pronkpops.wordpress.com. That's pronkpops, pronkpops.wordpress.com. And I have several, I think, very important and very informative videos from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And these are the doctors and nurses that man this center. And I encourage all of you to watch these videos. Now, I have a whole bunch of other ones. Because they've actually treated patients that have Ebola. They know how dangerous it is, but they've trained for it and trained for it. They've trained for it for years. They're one of the few facilities that are truly ready for it. Now, the one disturbing thing with me is, if you look at the equipment they use, as well as the equipment the U.S. Army use when they're doing research on Ebola, for example, or what they call a Category A disease, they're using spacesuits that oxygen is pumped into under positive pressure. They're not using the suits that the CDC is recommending and training hospital personnel to use. There's a reason for that. There's a shortage, and they're expensive. They're not cheap. They're over $1,000, folks. Now, one of the doctors makes the point, and I agree with their up to a point. You don't necessarily have to have the spacesuit to treat these patients. I understand that. But she emphasized, and so do the nurses, you really have to be trained and practice what they call donning and duffing the PPE, personal protective equipment. Because it's especially true when you take this equipment off or you duff it, you're taking it off, that you're very, very careful. Because on the outside of the suit, there can be these body fluids that are highly, highly infectious, especially if the patient that you're treating is exhibiting the late stages of this disease. They call it the hot zone. The people that deal with this disease, whether it's research or treating patients, call it the hot zone. They call it a hot zone for a reason. It's deadly, folks. You don't want to touch these body fluids. Now, getting back to our U.S. military personnel, I thought about it, and I've come up with an idea or a recommendation. We've already seen some complaint from Italians. Now, why Italians? Because U.S. personnel that were in West Africa are going to military bases that the Air Force has in Italy. And they don't particularly like our personnel that could potentially have the Ebola disease to be in Italy for 21 days. Now, they might be panicking. There's a lot of panic out there. I'm not panicking. I think the probability of any individual actually getting Ebola in the United States is slim and none. It's very low. You're more likely to die from the influenza virus or the flu than Ebola. The influenza virus kills thousands every year, mainly because it develops into pneumonia and people die of pneumonia, especially older and younger people that get the influenza flu. It's a killer. But the point is, everyone that gets the flu doesn't die. The mortality rate is still low, even though it's, and the reason why influenza is more deadly is because it's airborne. Now, this is the reason I mention that. There's a concern, there's an open debate and a concern whether or not the Ebola virus has actually mutated. And if it has, it could become airborne. And that makes it even worse. That makes it similar to influenza. And that could lead to a worldwide pandemic. The problem with Ebola is it's a killer. It's lethal. The low end, it's about 50%. On the high end, it's 95%. In other words, those are the people that die. In the current outbreak, it's running over 70%. It's already killed 5,000, and within a month, it'll be over 10,000, if not sooner. That's why you should be wearing the spacesuits. Now, if you don't have the money or the budget, you're going to have to use something else, the next best thing. You're going to need to wear PPE, but the question is it the right personal protection equipment? Now, we're learning. Dallas made many mistakes, but they were the first where a patient just walks in. Remember, up until late last month, about this time last month, there had not been one walk-in case of Ebola. Now, Presbyterian has some experience that you learn from your mistakes. Learning is making mistakes. And one of the mistakes is you need the necessary gear. That's a prerequisite. But you really need to have a teammate to ensure that you're putting on the equipment correctly as well as taking it off. And that's why I strongly urge you to spend a little time listening to the doctors and nurses at the University of Nebraska Medical Center that they have, they're one of four, what's called a biocontainment unit. Now, initially, I thought they had 10 beds. And initially, they did have 10 beds. But after reviewing the video, that's incorrect. And I am making a correction to some of my previous past shows. They said they only really have two because they are using the other rooms to store equipment, waste, personnel. So that dramatically decreases the number of the beds that are available in the United States by 8. It looks like we have a grand total of maybe 10 to 12 beds in the entire United States where the personnel are there, have training, and are ready to treat an Ebola patient. Four facilities where we have over 5,000 hospitals. See, the key to this is having the proper protocols, procedures which this medical facility, this biocontainment unit, developed over time. They've been working at this for many, many years. And you're going to get experience. They've learned from their mistakes and improved the situation and now can handle two Ebola patients. Two. And the reason is there's a lot of equipment in the Ebola patient's room. If it were another disease, they might be able to handle four. But for Ebola, there's only two rooms with the bed for the patient as well as some equipment. Our hospitals today are simply not prepared to deal with multiple cases of Ebola in a city. What if there were 100 cases just in Dallas? Presbyterian Hospital, even though it's a large facility, is not ready for 100 patients. They would be the first to tell you. There's a great demand in terms of people required to treat, and this is an intensive care situation, to treat primarily with supportive care an Ebola patient. That's why it's so expensive. My understanding of the bill for a Presbyterian handling that one patient, no one's ever going to pay this bill, by the way, is over $500,000 for one patient because it required a lot of people to treat that one patient that eventually died on October 8th, namely Thomas Eric Duncan. Now, I've sort of been jumping around a little. Now, let me get back to a key point. So after thinking about all this, the fact that we really don't have hospitals in the United States that are fully prepared to handle Ebola, now many of them are rapidly trying to develop plans, procedures, protocols, make sure they have the equipment, and really think about it and start training their personnel and practice, practice, practice. That's one of the good things about having this case in Dallas, that now a lot of hospitals across the nation are at least thinking about and hopefully doing something about the situation. What if a patient walks into this hospital? How are we going to handle it? From the time he presents himself at the reception desk, and yes, they're going to ask questions. Did you travel to Africa? Yes. Were you in Liberia? Yes. Were you in contact with an Ebola patient? Maybe. I don't know. Once they get those answers, they're going to isolate that person, hopefully, in a waiting room before they proceed and make sure that the people that have contact with that person are wearing the appropriate PPE, personal protective equipment. See, what you don't know when that person walks in is, where is he in terms of the incubation period? Does he have any symptoms? Well, if he's walking into the hospital, he probably has one or more of the symptoms. And when you do the appropriate test that the CDC recommends, within several hours, you will know, you will confirm the fact that either he has the Ebola virus or he doesn't. And it does take time to do that. What you don't want is a potential patient that walks in having the Ebola virus and sits in your waiting room, let's say coughing or sneezing, because that potentially infects everyone around them. Because if you're in that close contact, that body fluid can get on you, as well as the perspiration. And should he vomit and even a droplet touch your skin, you could very well get it. You know, the Boy Scouts have a motto, be prepared. That's what we're talking about, be prepared. And preparation, part of it's planning, but part of it's practice and practice and practice to where it comes second nature, but you still follow a checklist. I'm sure there are many of you out there that have gotten pilot licenses. And even though you've maybe have flown hundreds or thousands of hours, you still follow a checklist. And depending on the plane, you might have a co-pilot. And that's what we're talking about here. You need to have more than one person checking up that the person is, for example, putting on and taking off the gear properly. Because the people that treat the Ebola virus know it's during, especially taking off the equipment, that a high risk presents itself, that even though you've been wearing the equipment, when you take it off, you run the risk of touching any body fluid that's on your suit. So what do we need to do about our military personnel that are going there? I agree with Secretary Hagel's, as well as the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommendation, that our troops be quarantined for 21 days. I'm a big advocate of anyone that's had direct contact with Ebola patients in particular be put in quarantine. It's mandatory. It's not voluntary. And you got to stay there. You're not going to wander around. You got to stay home, or if you're in the military, stay in your barracks, stay in your quarters for 21 days. Yes, food should be provided. Some entertainment, whether it's books, television, radio, will be provided. But for 21 days, you will be monitored every day. Your temperature will be taken to make sure you don't have the Ebola virus. And should you develop the symptoms, then it's also mandatory that you be put in isolation. Namely, you'll be put in, ideally, a biocontainment unit with a biosafety level of 4, where the people in that unit are using spacesuits. Now, after thinking about it, what I recommend is we need a central location for where these troops that were on so-called Ebola responsive missions return to for a period of 21 days of mandatory quarantine and, if necessary, isolation. I think an ideal spot would be the U.S. Naval Station at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Remember, that's where we have in detention terrorists, and that's the place. And it's this prison that President Obama has threatened to shut down, but the American people don't want those prisoners brought to the United States. Likewise, the American people don't want Ebola patients brought to the United States. And why U.S. citizens that come back from West Africa should be allowed in, as well as be in a mandatory quarantine for 21 days and monitored by public health officials. Probably the best solution for a military is to confine them in a barracks quarters situation at this U.S. naval station. They're not in the United States, and they're not risking spreading the Ebola virus to any other units of the U.S. military, whether it's the Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy. And there's room there to do that. Because although we've made a commitment of 3,000, I understand it's been increased to 4,000, they're not all going to come back at once. So get them out of Italy or wherever else you may have them right now and put them in at this naval station, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Now, I think we needed to take another step, a rather important step. It's abundantly clear that in the continental United States, our hospitals simply are not prepared right now, and that can change over a period of time, to deal with an Ebola epidemic, should we ever have one, or anything approaching something like that. So what I suggest initially we do is set up also at this U.S. naval station, offshore, not in the United States, it's part of Cuba. We build a biocontainment facility there with the biosafety level of 4 and set up a 100-bed hospital. That should be more than adequate to support most, if not all, of our mission in West Africa. I hope we don't use one bed, but by building that facility, we could support not only our own troops, but should any U.S. citizens or volunteers from other countries that go to treat these West Africans and come down with the disease, they can be put in isolation in a biocontainment unit where the health workers are protected. Right now, we only have 4 facilities with very limited number of beds, at most a dozen, at most. So we need to dramatically increase that capacity. I'm just picking a number. I think 100 is a good number to start out with. It's going to take time to do this. They do have a hospital there, but what we're talking about really should be a separate wing or unit that can accommodate at least 100 patients, have the equipment and personnel dedicated to handle infectious diseases such as Ebola, so-called Category A. And I have in my notes, if you go to promptpops.wordpress.com, a list of the diseases that the Centers for Disease Control put in Category A. That would be a very positive move in terms of not only being able to quarantine people that have been there and currently don't have the symptoms, but should they develop the symptoms, right on site we would have the biocontainment unit there and they could be treated in that unit and hopefully with the aggressive supportive care, many, if not most, could survive a very lethal Ebola virus disease. I hope it's done. I hope this is taken seriously. And that would be very proactive. Now, some of you will probably raise this, so I'll raise it before you do. Cuba will probably object to this. The relationships between Cuba and the United States have been rather up and down. But you might not be aware of this. Cuba has sent many, many healthcare professionals to West Africa. That might surprise you. So should Cuban healthcare workers working in West Africa come down with the Ebola disease, I think the United States should offer to treat their health workers should they develop Ebola, as well as the healthcare workers of other nations. That is my rather small contribution to the discussion on what to do about people that don't have the symptoms, and you've heard my recommendation to put them in a 21-day mandatory containment. And I think that is what most, if not all, the states shortly, if they haven't done it already, will definitely mandate. It'll be across all 50 states. And it doesn't matter whether President Obama or the Centers for Disease Control agree with it or not. Because poll after poll, the American people are insisting on people that have treated Ebola patients be put in a mandatory quarantine for a period of 21 days where they're monitored every day by public health officials to make sure that they remain symptom-free and don't go out into their communities and infect people. Even though they might not intend it, that could happen. Even though the probability is small, it's still positive. It's not zero. We simply don't know enough about viruses and the Ebola virus to cavalierly rule this out as a practical and cautious move, because it is. And I think the comment of, I don't know who the person in Maine was, but she made the point, I'd rather one person spend 21 days in quarantine than have 21 deaths in my community. That's my point of view. Now, it might not be as bad in a rural situation such as Maine, but today most Americans live in cities or urban regions, not in rural Maine. I'm in Dallas. There are millions of people in Dallas, in the Fort Worth, the Dallas-Arlington-Fort Worth area. And if you include Plano, for example, which is a big suburb of Dallas, you're right at about 7 million people. And that's the danger. If you have a person walking around that doesn't even know he's infected because he hasn't seen the symptoms, we don't know at what exact point does that person, the virus, become contagious to other persons. And yes, we know that if you have direct bodily contact, you're probably going to get it. But what we don't know is when he does become contagious, and does this virus spread through the air, as some experts suspect it might, because it's rapidly spread in West Africa. Now, admittedly, one of the reasons why it's killing thousands, why in past outbreaks the number of cases and deaths were in the hundreds, is because you're in cities and towns with large populations. Well, that's the United States, folks. Most Americans today live in cities or in the suburbs of cities with a high population density. That's just another reason to err on the side of caution, to err on the side of caution. And yes, you're going to be inconvenienced for 21 days if you happen to get an order, a mandatory order, that you need to quarantine yourself in your home. And that requires that the public health officials in these states seek a court order. This isn't trying to be arbitrary about it. It's not trying to, I'm a little tired of this lady saying, violating my constitutional rights. Excuse me. Your rights don't trump the public health of your community, state, or nation. They simply don't. And this is why it's incumbent upon the governors and other public health officials to exercise your authority and powers to quarantine these people. And I'll be critical of any city mayor or governor that doesn't do this, because you are endangering the public health of your own people. And I find that unconscionable. Now, this nurse supposedly said, well, I don't intend to do it. Good intentions don't cut it. It's results. And if your actions result in people becoming infected that wouldn't have been infected had you stayed home for 21 days, then you're responsible for what you did. You're responsible for spreading the infection that you went over to West Africa to help patients. And I think all healthcare professionals that go over there need to seriously think about this. Now, some of them, it's no accident. I've met some arrogant doctors or nurses, but primarily doctors, that think they know it all. And the same thing with politicians. They think they're the smartest one in the room. And then they find out they're not the smartest one in the room. And this virus doesn't care what your political affiliation is. It'll kill you whether you're a Democrat or Republican, because for the virus, you're just a meal. And after they've killed you, they're going to be looking for another meal. In other words, trying to jump from your body to the next victim. So is encouraged to mutate and possibly do this when someone is in the latter stages of the disease and coughs up blood, vomit, diarrhea, sneezes, and it becomes airborne. And if you might be wearing what you think is state-of-the-art PPE suit, but if that suit does not have its own oxygen being pumped to you with positive pressure like they do in a biosafety level 4 lab, then you're running a risk, a small risk, but a risk. So you can't take an arrogant attitude towards this. I think hubris is the worst thing we can have here. I think everybody needs to have a little humility. And the phrase I've used when I was in financial services, and I'll repeat it again, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. I hope for the best for all of these people. I don't wish any of these healthcare providers come down with the disease. And I commend their efforts in trying to help the people of West Africa to stop it. But that doesn't give you a right to risk the health of your own community, your neighbors. And if that means a little inconvenience for 21 days, live with it. Live with it. There's been proposals that the government pay them for 21 days. I have to think a little bit about that, but there's something that needs to be said. Most people, and this is important and needs to be considered, most people need a paycheck, cannot go 21 days without money. They have rent to pay, a mortgage to pay. They have bills to pay, whether it's groceries, whatever. So that might there might be a small stipend to provide them enough money to cover the essentials of living when they're in that 21-day period. And you need to understand, it costs money to do all this, to monitor the people. And we fortunately have a very good public health service cadre, if you will, both on the national and the state level. But the primary way they deal with this is what's called contract tracing. They're trying to find out if someone it does have the Ebola virus, who were they in contact with, to alert them. And unfortunately, if you've had a lot of contact with, probably need to put them in quarantine. That has been the way that we've tried to stop diseases in the past. Quarantine people, usually in their own home, trying to determine who the people have been in contact with and put them in quarantine so the disease, whatever it is, does not spread throughout the community. That works when you're dealing with a handful of cases. But if this should explode, in other words, become very much like West Africa is, and I'm not saying it's going to do that, but you don't want to run that risk. Because if suddenly you're dealing with every major city in the United States having dozens of cases, confirmed cases of Ebola patients, you can throw out contract tracing. We're beyond the point of that being effective. Now, another thing you need to consider is, and I've already brought it up, the economic consequences of an epidemic. And they're significant. People will start staying home. They will not go out shopping or the movies or any other public gathering. You will see an impact on the gross domestic product. And that's just people being concerned. Whether or not it's justified is another matter. But there is a psychology to this, and it could adversely affect the growth of our economy. And it could put us in a recession or depression. We're not there yet, but that's why you have to be proactive and really aggressively proactive in dealing with this. So I hope I don't hear any more about this nurse from Maine. I hope her and her partner stay home for 21 days. Enjoy each other's company. Watch a lot of television. Listen to a lot of music. Read books, whatever is your passion. But please stay home for your benefit as well as the benefit of the citizens of Maine as well as the United States. Because that's what a Texas nurse that returned 2 days ago from West Africa did. She accepted the fact that she needed to be quarantined for 21 days. You haven't heard her name. She's home today being monitored every day somewhere in Texas. Her temperature is taken. And I hope after 21 days, she's no symptoms have manifest themselves. She is Ebola free. That's the objective, folks. We don't want America to have an epidemic of the Ebola virus. Because that virus is just one of many. The flu virus, the influenza virus, is much more deadly. It kills a lot more people. You hear about it as people die of pneumonia, especially older people, but also younger people. It's very deadly. It kills thousands every year. Thousands. The death certificate might say pneumonia, but it was the flu. It was influenza. That's why it's a good idea for most people to get the flu shot. But that's a personal decision. You can run the risk, and if you get the flu, hopefully you won't get pneumonia. And hopefully it's not influenza or another deadly virus that's mutated, because you get it because it's airborne, it's easy to get. For most people, it's not deadly. Only a small fraction of a percent actually die of it. But millions get it, and unfortunately, several thousands die of it. So you need to have a little perspective, and I do have that perspective. Am I trembling about the Ebola virus? No. I believe by Thanksgiving, which is not too far away, Dallas will be Ebola free if we have no other people in the immediate area of Dallas having come down with the symptoms. I hope and pray that happens. That would really be a joyous Thanksgiving. But I hope the same can be said of New York City, because we don't know how many people that doctor has infected. He didn't intend to infect anybody. He thought he knew best, that he was Ebola-free, didn't have the symptoms. But what happened? In that 21-day period, he developed the symptoms. And now he's fighting for his life. And even though the New York City has an excellent public health department, they probably identified many of the people that he's come in contact. There are many more that they don't have a clue who they are. And they might be spreading it right now in one of the densely populous cities in the world, certainly in the United States. So why run a risk? That's what I keep coming back to. Why run a risk? Admittedly, a small risk at all. Will it inconvenience some people for 21 days? Yes, it will. But relax. Go home. Catch up on your movie viewing, your television, your reading, whatever. And maybe after 21 days, you'll have a sigh of relief, as will everyone in your family, your friends, and your community. And then you can celebrate the holidays. That is one of the good outcomes. The other is our hospitals need to start planning and become prepared for dealing with a very deadly disease such as Ebola. So that is one of the also good outcomes of what happened in Dallas. I think it has alerted all the hospitals in the United States that they need to start thinking about planning and preparing for one or more patients walking in. It might never happen, but you need to be prepared. And that's why I'm also recommending that the United States military seriously consider sending our troops that have been in West Africa, those countries that are highly infected with the Ebola virus, send those troops to the U.S. Naval Station in Guantanamo, Cuba, and quarantine them there for 21 days. Obviously, keep them separate from the other personnel that are there, and start building and supporting a biosafety containment unit at that base, just as we've done in Dallas, Texas. We have already set up a biocontainment unit, a joint effort by the state and several hospitals in Texas. So if we have other cases of the Ebola virus, they will be sent there if they're in the Dallas area. That's the prudent thing to do. That's the wise thing to do. Now, I need to say one other word. Why is the president resisting this? Not the military aspect. I think there his hand was more or less forced by his military commanders. They understood that if any of these soldiers did come down with the Ebola virus, this could easily spread to other units. That's why he reluctantly went along with what Secretary Hagel ordered that the services do. And remember, those people are volunteers. They follow orders. And they will follow the orders now of the commanders. that if you've been over there, you're going to be in quarantine. I would centralize this and put these people in at that U.S. Naval Air Station there in a separate area, separate from all the people that are there, with the exception of some support people that they're going to need, for a period of 21 days, and also provide, and it's going to take time, but you have some time right now, either build or equip a wing of, for example, they have a hospital there. I don't know how large it is. I've seen some photographs. It's certainly not in the league of Presbyterian that has multiple buildings. But you could start small. Set up a biocontainment unit, maybe only 10 patients initially. But over time, expand it to 100 beds. And that could be used to support not only any military personnel that come down with the Ebola virus. In other words, they have to be put in what's called mandatory isolation, and that's usually in a hospital unit, such as at the University of Nebraska. That really does. That's probably one of the best. There's only four, but one of the best facilities to be sent to because they've had the training. They know what they're doing. They've practiced this, and they got their first patient only a couple of weeks ago, actually. But start the wheels turning to develop and build and man and support a biosafety level 4 biocontainment hospital on this U.S. Naval Station. And that would support not only U.S. military personnel that should they come down with the disease, but also any healthcare workers, not only from the United States, but from around the world, should they become infected with the disease. And you might even seriously consider, if space allows, that the people from other countries that send volunteers, healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, other support personnel to treat the Ebola patients in West Africa, that prior to that, they going home to wherever country they're from, that they also be sent to Guantanamo Bay, the naval station there, be put in quarantine, a mandatory quarantine, for 21 days. So this is an opportunity for the United States to lead. This is an opportunity for President Obama to lead. This is an opportunity for the World Health Organization and other nations to mobilize its forces, but also to support those healthcare workers that are on the front lines, that are in the hot zone. And that's what it's called, the hot zone, because when a patient is in the final stages of the Ebola virus disease, his body is a hot zone. It's highly contagious. It's easy then to get the virus if your body comes in direct contact with any of the body fluids of that patient. This, I hope, will be for a while my last show on the Ebola virus. But it seems every day when I wake up, there's a new angle to this or a new development. And I thought I would contribute my own angle to this. And it's somewhat creative, and it's going to take cooperation. It's going to take resources and effort. But this is a way to protect not only the people of the United States, but the people of other nations, should they mobilize and send healthcare workers to West Africa, that on their return, they are quarantined for 21 days at a central location outside of all those nations on a U.S. naval base. That should any of those health workers, whether they're from the United States or any other nation, they can be treated at a biocontainment hospital where we have the beds, the doctors, the staff, the experts to support them. I hope the powers that be, both in the Department of Defense, the United States Department of State, as well as the President of the United States and the White House, seriously consider my recommendation. It's yours. Please implement it. It could save lives. It could prevent an epidemic in the United States or a pandemic in the world from spreading. And it requires international cooperation. It requires money and resources. But it's the right thing to do. And I hope we do it. And let's remember, we have an election coming up. And the president seems to be reluctant to support the governors of these states. My suspicion all along, he's playing politics with this. He doesn't want the American people to make the connection between what's happening in the Ebola crisis and what he plans to do, supposedly after the election, by granting amnesty to millions, tens of millions of illegal aliens already in the United States. The American people have already made that connection. They know that one of the reasons the CDC, as well as the president, has insisted that the flights continue into the United States, as his own director of the CDC alluded to, is if we stop the flights, and that's what the American people are demanding, both Republicans and Democrats are demanding, and he better do it soon, or he's going to have a revolt on his hand. That, again, is the prudent, cautious way to proceed, to contain and hopefully suppress the Ebola disease where it broke out. And what you don't allow is people from those countries to come into the United States, even if at the time they're symptom-free. Remember, the gentleman that died in Dallas, he came to the United States under those procedures, and he's dead. And the doctor, who's now in Bellevue Hospital fighting for his life, that's how he got here. What we don't know is we've had about 5,000 a month for at least the last 6 months to a year of people from West Africa entering the United States, primarily landing at those five designated airports in New York, New Jersey, Chicago, Illinois, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C. How many of them have the virus? Now, the argument is, well, if we stop the flights, then they'll get here illegally. Yeah, that's a distinct possibility, but what are you not considering? Many of them are already here. They're coming here illegally because they can't get the visas for whatever reason. The danger is they spread it into Central America, and then you have millions of Central Americans, including Mexicans, invading the United States, not only for jobs, but also for health care. I agree with the president and the CDC director that you have to stop it in West Africa. And so does anyone else that's considered this. That's the place to stop it. That's the red line, if you will. You should stop it there, which means you stop the flow of both legal immigrants into the United States with visas. You got to get a visa if you're from that country to come into the United States, and only the Department of State can issue that. So shut that down now. And then you have to secure the U.S. border to stop illegal immigration by illegal aliens crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. You see, President Obama doesn't want the American people to make that connection. And I'm telling him, many people that are following this are already making that connection, and they're worried about it. And what is the president going to do? He doesn't have the authority. He doesn't make the laws that he can grant legal status to tens of millions of illegal aliens that are here. And that's what he's planning to do. Now, should he carry out his threat, two things are going to happen. The American people are going to push back hard, and they're going to demand his impeachment and conviction for endangering the lives of the American people and ignoring the fact that you have 20 to 30 million either unemployed or underemployed Americans that can't find permanent jobs because both Republican and Democratic administrations have not rigorously enforced current immigration law. There will be a backlash that will spin the head of this president, and he'll be reviled should he carry out his threat. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he is in a bubble surrounded by enablers that are telling him it's the right thing to do, when the American people in poll after poll after poll have said, while we support legal immigration, we do not support illegal immigration. You don't reward criminal aliens by giving them legal status, whether it's in a form of permanent legal residence or an employment authorization document. And that's what the U.S. government, bureaucracy is doing. They have an RFP out for upwards of 34 million of these cards. And who would get these cards? Illegal aliens. And what does that encourage? It encourages more illegal aliens to invade the United States. See, that's the dirty little secret of why the President of the United States is resisting a ban on travel from these countries. He doesn't want the connection drawn. Mr. President, people are drawing that connection already. I'm one of many. So when you try to dictate to the American people, they have a tendency to push back. And that's why in less than 4 days, there's an election. And I think the Democratic candidates, and many of them already know it, many of them decided not to run, know that they're going to be out of office. Because when you ignore the will of the American people, they might be slow, but eventually they wake up and they'll throw the bums out, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, when they go against the will, the wishes, and the concerns of the American people. And that is fundamentally about jobs, the economy, and now the public health. So yes, you can act like a dictator and issue these cards, but you'll pay a high price. And that price will be impeachment, conviction, and you'll be out of the White House early. Should you pull the trigger and give amnesty to millions of illegal aliens, you'll go down in history, and that will be one of your legacies, because Obamacare ultimately will be repealed. And that's one of the reasons you're going to have what I call a wipeout election for the Democratic Party come Tuesday, November 4th. Oh, yes, I could be wrong, but I don't think so. I'm an independent. I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I'm really disgusted with both parties, mainly over fiscal irresponsibility of both parties. And what I mean by that, the inability to balance budgets. Everyone I know, individuals, families, businesses, churches, charities, cities, counties, towns, churches, they all have to balance the budget. But we have a federal government, and it doesn't matter whether it's Republicans in power or Democrats in power, that simply can't balance the budget. And they make promises, and they play games with the budget baseline, but they never balance the budget. In other words, they're spending trillions of dollars more than the American people can support in terms of the size and scope of the government. There are certain functions, and there are really only two, maybe three, that it is the responsibility of the government to do, and that is to protect its people from foreign invasion, but also to protect its people from disease, microbes, viruses that threaten the health of the American people. That is one, actually two, of the legitimate functions of government. And they're not doing a good job of either, sad to say. And when you combine that with the failure of this president's economic policies as well as his foreign policy, the American people are making the connection. Who supported President Obama? They're running in the House of Representatives to get reelected as congressmen or representatives, and they're also running for Senate seats. The American people Tuesday have an opportunity to throw those people out. If you don't like President Obama's economic policies, if you don't like his foreign policy, if you don't like the way he's handled the Ebola virus or the illegal immigration situation, and the fact you have one of the highest unemployment rates other than during the Great Depression all through Obama's administration, then I don't think you have a choice come Tuesday. I wouldn't like to be a Democrat running to get reelected again. I don't think you have a prayer. Oh, you have the Democratic machine in its bases, and they're trying to get the vote out. But this election will be very much a wipeout or wave election, largely in protesting the actions in Washington, D.C. of the Democratic Party and Barack Obama. And I think come Wednesday, the writing will be on the wall. It will be clear. And then if President Obama has the nerve in December or even earlier, to try to pull what he keeps threatening to do, namely provide amnesty or legal status for tens of millions of illegal aliens are here, you're going to see a revolt. You're going to see phone calls and demands throughout the country to impeach him, and the House will impeach him. It remains to be seen whether he will be convicted, but there will be more than one count to the articles of impeachment. Now, what Congress is waiting for is public opinion to turn against him, and it has been turning. His popularity has gone down, down, and down. Has it hit bottom? No. When it goes below 30%, it's hit bottom, because then you're dealing with the true believers in the Democratic Party. Presidents are always going to have hard support of between 20 and 30% of the people. But when you lose 70% of the people, your days are numbered, because jobs are a major concern of the American people. What's happening abroad is a concern. But when you're talking about life and death situations and the possibility of an epidemic or pandemic, for not taking aggressive actions to stop this disease from spreading into the United States, should the president take an arrogant action like this, he might not be president that much longer. We're far away from that point. It's not going to happen right away. He holds his future in his hands, and he might have people surrounding him telling him what he's doing is the right thing to do, even though poll after poll of the American people have said, we want current immigration laws enforced, and we oppose illegal immigration. That's Democrats, Republicans, progressives, liberals, conservatives, libertarians, whites, blacks, and Hispanics. You have to control our borders. If you're a sovereign nation, control of your borders is essential. You got to protect the American worker, not allow 30 to 50 million illegal aliens invading this country under both Republican and Democrat leadership. The elites in Washington, what I call the political elitist establishment, has lost contact with the American people. They are fundamentally disconnected. Now, some of them understand what I'm saying, but most of them don't. And what's happening, and you see it, is more and more people are leaving both parties. They're not happy with the Republican Party, and they're certainly not happy with the Democratic Party, because they've been lied to, manipulated, taken advantage of, overtaxed, overregulated, and they're sick of the attitude coming out of Washington, D.C., both in Congress, whether it's the House, the Senate, and the White House, the public be damned. More and more people are waking up. That is what I call the P's, the political elitist establishment's attitude. We're going to do what we think is best, and we don't care what your opinion is. We don't care what your concern is. The only thing that interest does is we remain in power. Well, this coming Tuesday, you're going to get a lesson. You're going to get an education. And this should be a warning both to Democrats and Republicans. You, too, can be voted out of office. Maybe not this year, but in 2 years, or 4 years, or 6 years, or 8 years. This situation is not going to be turned around in one election. The American people understand that, and it most likely will require another political party, because neither the Republicans or the Democrats are listening very hard. Many of them talk a good game, but they don't walk a good game. They're all talk. No action, no results. I'm looking at the clock. I've been a little over on this show, but I want to conclude my show on a positive note with the playing of a song. Sing along with it. I think you know the words. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College.